2 minutes to respond to questions from the audience, which I will ask, and then 2 minutes for closing comments. We've flipped a coin, and Jim Hensley will start and with the first opening comment, and then he'll have the last closing comment, and Mr. Tracy will be second and then be first to close. We're going to have lights so that we keep them on schedule. As always, we're grateful to the center's help in giving us the rooms each time. It's going to be even better when they move to the center of Belvedere in the spring. There'll be more better parking, so you won't have to park in the overflow lot and walk up, but we're still very grateful. We welcome you to join the Senior Statesmen of Virginia and present any ideas that you have for programs. And again, you can use the cards and give them to me or anybody with a blue badge on for ideas. And if you're interested in being on the board, we're in the process now of thinking about the board for next year. So we'd love self-nominations. So if you have an interest in political, governmental, educational, or social issues that are important to seniors, I welcome your involvement with the next year's board. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, November 13th, and that will be centered on the transportation issues in Central Virginia. The state Secretary of Transportation, Shannon Valentine, will be here, as well as John Lynch, who's the Culpeper District Engineer that's responsible for data VDOT operations in our area. Please, if you will, we use wireless microphones and wireless connections. If you don't mind, power off your cell phones. Not only turn it to vibrate, but power it off if you don't mind, so that, because it will or may interrupt with the wireless system here that we use. And I understand if you need to check your stock prices, just turn it back on, check, and turn it back off. So based on the coin flip, I'm going to ask Jim Hensley to start with an opening comment for 3 minutes, please.
All right. Well, good afternoon. First off, I want to thank the Senior Statesmen of Virginia for organizing this forum. And I want to also thank all of you for coming out today. I think it might be helpful to start off by telling you why I'm in this race. This wasn't in my plans when I retired as public defender 3 years ago, thinking I'd spend more time with my wife, kids, and grandkids. Some retirement. And I'm certainly not a politician. So here it is. What's happening in the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office has alarmed many people in our community. And I've become a candidate to make the case for changing the direction our criminal justice system is headed. Our community can and should end the outdated policies that have led to mass incarceration. We must have a fair and just system that works for everyone and not just a few. And victims of crime deserve an experienced advocate who can get the job done and can provide justice for our community. These are goals I can accomplish. I've handled thousands of criminal cases during the 43 years I've been a lawyer. I love the work I do, and I know the criminal justice system in and out. I started the Albemarle Public Defender's Office, and as head of that office for 18 years, I mentored lawyers and taught them how to try criminal cases. I have taught criminal law at the University of Virginia Law School for 20 years. I can prosecute cases in an organized and effective manner, and I can successfully prepare victims, police officers, and other witnesses for complicated trials. Unfortunately, during Robert Tracy's time in office, we've seen how inexperience can wreck a prosecution. Time is short here, so maybe I can talk more about that when we have questions. Right now, I want you to know more about me. I'm a really good lawyer. I have spent my life fighting for clients who've had the deck stacked against them. It's hard work, but I've been there for my clients every time. And believe me, I've helped to change a lot of lives. That's the kind of passion I'll bring to protecting our community. I'll be a tireless advocate for victims. I won't make rookie mistakes when it comes to prosecuting dangerous, violent criminals and removing them from the community. And for those others who justly deserve second chances, I will find ways to hold them accountable while helping them get back on their feet. When we do that, the risk of their reoffending goes down and our community is a safer place. This election gives voters a say in determining the future of our criminal justice system. Choose me and you will have a prosecutor who uses discretion wisely, a prosecutor whose approach to cases is shaped by common sense and experience.
No. He's working on it right now. Do you want to pull it closer, maybe?
Hello?
This won't count against you.
I understand. Oh, that's working now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you to the senior statesman for hosting this event and for everyone for being here. It is my honor to serve as your Commonwealth's attorney, and I'm running this time for the same reason I ran last time. It's because I love Albemarle County, and I think a functional legal system is absolutely essential to preserving public safety and providing people the dignity to live without fear in their own community. A little bit about my background. As you know, I was a graduate of the University of Illinois Law School, worked on Capitol Hill on the House Judiciary Committee, served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General, worked on bipartisan legislation in both institutions, came down here as a federal prosecutor, and ran for this office because I saw a clear injustice in the community. And I was given a 4-year term and had very specific priorities I wished to see enacted, and I'm proud to have a record that reflects those commitments. We created a diversionary docket for nonviolent offenders who have mental health issues. I see people who worked with me on that, including Albie LaFave and Shannon Neal. And I'm very proud of helping establish that nonviolent therapeutic docket to ensure that people with mental health conditions are given judicially supervised treatment rather than jail. Also expanded the number of people in the drug court, and I'm proud of that accomplishment as well. We also sought to ensure accountability for violent crime, and we have prioritized prosecutions for those who prey on the elderly in our community by establishing an elder abuse task force. I've presented here on multiple occasions, worked with Delegate Toscano on a bipartisan bill to enhance investigations and prosecutions of those offenses. We also have prioritized violent crime prosecutions by addressing violent crime where it occurs in our community without apology, by holding violent offenders accountable. We prosecuted MS-13 cases. We've done more sexual assault cases. We brought UVA into Title IX into our sexual assault response team before it was statutorily required. And we also have held accountable people who have been engaged in commercial sex trafficking, which is a problem in our community that we must face. Going forward, I will continue to place the law in the context it deserves to be as Commonwealth's attorney. A Commonwealth's attorney's authority is derived from his or her willingness to faithfully apply the law. That's what the oath of office means. And when a Commonwealth's attorney disregards that oath of office and assumes an ideological label and a non-prosecution mantra, like my opponent, public safety will suffer. I am in favor of accountability, but I'm also in favor of ensuring that we give nonviolent offenders treatment and recovery options, and also the right to return to society after they paid their dues to society with every chance of success. So with that, it has been my privilege to serve as your Commonwealth's attorney, and I look forward to answering the questions you might have.
So thank you. Perfect time to start the questions from the audience. The first question, and I'll start with Mr. Tracy since he went last. The first question is, the country has grown weary from all the gun violence. So far this year, there's been more mass shootings than days. Earlier this summer, one in Virginia Beach. What are your ideas for controlling gun violence? And what about universal background checks, red flag laws, and any other issues that might control some of the gun violence?
I think the governor said it well when he said, we must never become inured to mass shootings in this country. And I completely share that sentiment. The Second Amendment is a personal right. The Supreme Court has held clearly that it's a personal right. So limitations on the Second Amendment must respect that individual right and individual liberty. And as a constitutional officer and a law enforcement officer, we have an obligation to uphold the Constitution and all of its provisions, including the Second Amendment. With respect to some of these laws that have been recommended, I know there's a law in Congress that is gaining some support. There is an increasing awareness that we can and should do more to ensure that people who may pose a threat to public safety are separated in a timely fashion from that risk that might be presented to society. And it's important to ensure that any law in any proposal respect the due process rights of citizens. Those laws, some of which would summarily separate someone from personal property and infringe on a basic constitutional right, lack due process. And we must be vigilant to ensure that we respect due process rights and take steps necessary to protect public safety.
Thank you. Mr.
Hensley. Well, thank you. There were three parts to the question. What are my views on gun violence? And I think that as a candidate for prosecutor, the most important response that a prosecutor can have to gun violence is to be an effective prosecutor and prosecute people who have been charged with gun crimes. That's the primary responsibility of the prosecutor and the prosecutor's office. And I have the experience to be able to do that effectively, and I will do that effectively. Now, the other two issues that were raised in the question had to do with proposed legislation. So with respect to proposed legislation, that is more of an advisory view that I might be able to give that is not central to the office of the prosecutor. So with respect to the two items, the universal background checks and the red flag laws, I agree entirely with Mr. Tracy that any new legislation has to incorporate due process protections. That's fundamental to our Constitution, and I certainly support that. Now, red flag laws, I support red flag laws as a matter of policy. That's my view. That's not an official position that prosecutors it's not an official part of a prosecutor's duty, but here we are, we're politicians, and so let's talk about what our views are. I support red flag laws. I also support universal background check legislation. I think it's long overdue, and I hope that the people in our state and local governments can get together and really do something significant to prevent gun violence.
Thank you. And this will be for Mr. Hensley first. And question is, the image from the illegal torch march on the Friday night before the Unite for Rights rally down the lawn and the assault of UVA faculty, students, and community members protecting the statue of Thomas Jefferson on the evening of August 11th seared in the mind of the citizens. And so the question for both of you is, if you were prosecutor at the time, would you have handled the prosecution of some of the folks on the Friday night differently than Mr. Tracy did? And then when I get to Mr. Tracy, as you look back, what would you have done differently? So, Mr. Andrew.
All right, thank you. I mean, our whole community was torn apart by the things that happened here on August 11th and August 12th. Now, what happened at the university on August 11th was torch-wielding terrorists who came to the university and terrorized people in this community, students, faculty. And the University of Virginia is in the jurisdiction of Albemarle County. So the question is presented, what do you do to respond to that terrorist incident? So I only know what has been reported in the news media, but I think we can draw some conclusions from that information. And the conclusion that I would draw is that there was sufficient evidence of committing a crime to justify a prosecution. And I'm not saying how the prosecution would have come out, because I don't have all the facts, and of course, that's why you go to court. You bring a charge, and you go to court to find out what the court believes is an appropriate and just outcome. So I believe that there is sufficient evidence on the face of it to have brought charges. Now, Mr. Tracy disagrees, and he says not only is there insufficient evidence to bring charges, but he goes to such an extreme that he says he would be ethically prohibited from bringing charges. I totally disagree with that, and other criminal law experts in our community disagree with that. Look at Dave Chapman's memorandum, which is in the public record, saying that a prosecution would be on firm ground. Look at Ann Coughlin, the University of Virginia Law School criminal law professor, to the same extent. So yes, I think there's sufficient evidence to move forward with the case, and I certainly back then, if I had been prosecutor, would have done that.
Okay. So what would you have done differently looking back?
Well, I appreciate my opponent acknowledging that he doesn't have the facts necessary, so it's sort of inconsistent to say he would have gone forward acknowledging the fact that he doesn't have the facts necessary to establish probable cause. I fundamentally disagree with him, and this reflects his lack of prosecution experience of any kind, that you should indict a case to see what happened. And he said words to that effect, and that ought to concern everyone in this room. When a prosecutor brings a case, he or she must have probable cause. And the special rules of a prosecutor in 3.8 of the Rules of Professional Responsibility establish that bright line rule. And the model rules of professional responsibility in the ABA rules say not only probable cause, but proof at all stages beyond a reasonable doubt. He just acknowledged that as a prosecutor, he would indict cases to see what criminal conduct had occurred. That's inconsistent with the rules of professional responsibility. I share the abhorrence of everybody who saw that hate in the county. There were three torch marches, one in May, one in August, and one in October 2017. It's important to recognize that Tim Havey, who wrote the independent investigation report, who's now the UVA general counsel, on pages 174 and 175, recommended changing the statute to encompass an open flame and to make sure that the intent standard was lower. He wouldn't have been wasting his ink in that report if he didn't see a problem with that statute. That's important to recognize. Second, David Toscano introduced a bill to codify that change, further confirming deficiencies of the statute. Prosecutor has to have the courage and confidence to prosecute cases without regard to identity and with regard to the conduct in question. It's a fundamental difference between me and my opponent in this race. It's important to keep that in mind in all cases. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt, probable cause to indict, irrespective of the identity of defendants. Thank you.
So let me go to a very short question, and it's a function of what your background. Question for, I'll start with Ms. Tracy first. When did you establish residence in Alma County, and are you eligible to vote? And Mr. Hens will answer the same question.
I established jurisdiction or residency in Albemarle in 2008, I believe. I was in D.C. I'm here because my wife did her surgical training at UVA and finished her fellowship here, and that's why I'm here. I'm here to support her and my family. So yes, I'm absolutely eligible to vote in this race for Commonwealth Attorney.
All right. Thank you. I moved to Albemarle County in 1971. I lived out by Stone Robinson Elementary School, and I moved here after I'd been a high school teacher for 2 years, and I was in the VISTA program. And by the way, 1971, I think, was before Mr. Tracy was born. While I had been a public high school teacher under the Volunteers in Service to America program, I went to vocational school at night, and I became a welder. And I worked in Albemarle County for 2 years as a welder. I worked in Albemarle County factories. Those factories are no longer here. Building Systems, which was located out near Wegmans, and Chemtron, which was located out on Old Ivy Road. So the beginnings of my contact with this community date to 1971. Over the years, I've been a lawyer here. I went to the University of Virginia Law School, and I've been a lawyer and practiced in the Albemarle court system, which is where the prosecutor does his or her work for 34 years. That's my connection to the community. I presently live in the city. I do not live in the county. And the law allows that I can live in the city while running for this office. And the two prosecutors before Mr. Tracy similarly lived in the city at the time of their election, Denise Lunsford, and before her, Jim Camblos.
Thank you.
So I think he didn't answer whether he's eligible to vote.
I said I live in the city, and I think it's understood that if you live in the city, you're not eligible to vote in the county.
Just wanted to clarify that. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. And starting with Mr. Hensley, the first question for you now is define the difference between upholding the law and promoting social justice, and Mr. Tracy will answer after you do.
Well, there is no difference between upholding the law and promoting social justice, because upholding the law is the job that a prosecutor has to promote justice. Now, you use the term social justice. We can use different terms, but I think the heart of the matter is the prosecutor's job is to promote justice. And so I get a lot of criticism from Mr. Tracy for being somebody who disregards the law because I have an ideological label attached to my name. And the ideological label that he refers to most often is progressive. So does that mean that I'd be interested in specific examples where I disregard the law? I don't believe that I've ever said that, nor do I intend to disregard the law. I think in terms of this question, what the prosecutor needs to do is regard the law and all of the options that are in the law to promote justice in the community. And the big thing that the prosecutor has is prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutors make decisions all the time, and they make decisions to promote justice. Let me give you a quick example because time's running out here. You might have somebody who's shoplifted a couple of times, and they come in with stealing a candy bar, it's the third time. And that is a charge which could require a felony charge. Now, the prosecutor has a decision. The prosecutor is not required by law, it's not required to uphold the law to charge that person with a felony offense. That person could be charged in the discretion of the prosecutor with a lesser offense. And that's what I mean by promoting justice and using prosecutorial discretion for that purpose.
Three quick points. I didn't refer to my opponent as a progressive prosecutor. He refers to himself as a progressive prosecutor on his webpage and social media. I think it's important to recognize that any ideological label defining a prosecutor undermines equal justice under law and the idea that everyone should get a fair shake in court. And it's also very disrespectful to victims of crime. You asked about what crime that you might not prosecute. You were on WINA and you said malicious wounding was often too punitive. It's a 5 to 20 year statutory range for injuring, disfiguring, maiming, or threatening to kill someone. And I think it's an appropriate sanction to have a significant punishment like that, at least the possibility. My opponent thought those cases should resolve as simple assault and battery. I think that's a mistake, and I do think that undermines the law. Because prosecutorial discretion is kind of like using a company credit card. You get to use it sometimes when there are exceptional circumstances, but when you abuse that discretion, when you use it without regard to the General Assembly and you substitute your will for that of the General Assembly, you're undermining the separation of powers and you are embezzling the credibility of the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office and the law enforcement community that the Commonwealth's Attorney serves.
May I have
I'm sorry, I've got some time left. And you heard it from my opponent. Social justice is the same as enforcing the laws. You know, have some humility to recognize the prosecutor movement, the progressive prosecutor movement, is just as inappropriate as a conservative prosecutor movement. And what would people in this room think if there were a movement of conservative prosecutors who said, with regard to this law, this type of offense, and this type of offense, I'm going to disregard the General Assembly as a matter of course? That's not discretion, that's statutory nullification.
And may I have...
As a moderator, I have the option of giving each candidate another 1 minute to respond, and then I have the next question after that. Yeah. So 1 minute.
Thank you. With respect to the comment about malicious wounding, I never said that I wouldn't prosecute malicious wounding, and this goes to what I said in my first part of this answer. I don't want to disregard the law, but I want to look at the law in all its complexity. I've handled literally hundreds of malicious wounding cases, and I know that when you see it come in the door and charged as malicious wounding, it is not necessarily going to be a malicious wounding case. There are different grades of the offenses, and Mr. Tracy mentioned one of them, which is assault and battery. I've been to juries, I've been to courts. I want to look at those sorts of cases, as I would look at all cases, to see where the case ought to land in the interest of justice. And just because it's charged one way doesn't mean that it doesn't end up another way, and that's why a prosecutor has to look at it very carefully. So I want to clarify that with respect to what was said about my attitude on that.
Mr. Tracy, 1 minute. 1 minute.
Those were his words. As I said, I think the authority, think about it from a civics perspective, separation of powers. Judicial branch and executive officers take an oath to support our laws and Constitution, and that's the legislator, the legislative body, telling the other branches, who are equal and co-equal, your obligation is to enforce our law. And in the Federalist Papers, there is a discussion. Madison talks about the legislative power and its general applicability. That's why the legislative process is difficult. It's bicameral, legislative, parliamentary. I understand how the process works. It's deliberately and intentionally complex because those laws apply to everyone. It is inconsistent with our form of government for a prosecutor to summarily disregard the General Assembly. That's not how our system works. And those separations of powers are a bulwark against tyranny, and violating them is an invitation to that kind of disorder and that kind of substitution of the legislative will for that of the individual prosecutor.
So let me follow up that the last two comments, and that is, and starting with Mr. Tracy first, do you see or have you experienced times where you have not prosecuted when it appears that a crime had been committed?
Absolutely.
And
we do
give
so
examples?
This therapeutic mental health docket. People enter a plea, and if they finish supervised mental health training, that charge is either reduced or dismissed. Same with drug court. There are circumstances that may be exceptional in presented cases where there's a problem with a search or something else requiring an additional consideration of the charge. There are circumstances where cases are improperly charged by a law enforcement officer, and we make provision with that. With that approach comes recognition that we have an obligation to faithfully apply the law, utilize that discretion in a disciplined manner, and not substitute our will for that of the General Assembly. We utilize discretion all the time, but my opponent, as a matter of policy, as a progressive prosecutor, embraces the role of saying, I am a transformative agent, and that's a role for the legislative branch, not one constitutional officer.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Tracy just said it. Absolutely, he does not prosecute some of the time. That's what I'm talking about. It's the decision-making process. When do you decide to prosecute, or when do you decide to reduce a charge, or when do you decide not to prosecute at all because there are circumstances? And he also gave another circumstance that prosecutors need to look at when a case comes in, and that's it might be improperly charged. So that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that because I am a progressive and call myself a progressive that I'm going to disregard the law. I'm going to intelligently look at the cases when they come in and decide whether they should be prosecuted, what reasons there might be for not prosecuting, or whether they've been properly charged, or whether the evidence, even if it's properly charged, whether the evidence at the end of the day is going to be sufficient to gain a conviction. So I do intend to look at cases in a disciplined way, and I agree with Mr. Tracy that prosecutors need to be disciplined, but my discipline is informed by my values. And that's what I mean by being a progressive prosecutor. My values come into that process.
Thank you. Mr. Hensley, that you get to answer this question first. It's well known that our country incarcerates more people per capita than any democracy that we would care to compare ourselves to. Within the U.S., Virginia ranks 16th highest in per capita incarceration, but fourth lowest in the rates of violent crime. What are your thoughts about the impact, good or bad, of all this incarceration in this country and for our state?
Well, I think the impact is bad. This is a term that I used when I spoke earlier, mass incarceration. We are in the era where we are still in Albemarle County following the policies of mass incarceration that are outdated. They come up from the 80s and 90s. So what does mass incarceration mean? It means exactly what you just said. We keep people in jail who shouldn't be in jail, and we keep people who might be able to be in jail for a lot longer than they should be. So what can we do about it? I think that we need to keep people in the community to the extent that that's possible. And I think my experience as a public defender with the people who come in contact with the criminal justice system gives me the experience to identify opportunities to do things differently. And when I say keep people in the community, I mean, number one, they don't walk out of the courthouse door when the case is over. They walk out into the community under intensive supervision so we can keep track of what's going on with them. Then number two, they're going to, while they're in the community, get help. We know that substantial drivers of criminal behavior are substance abuse and mental illness, so let's get them help and treatment for those issues. We know there are other things that are driving criminal behavior, poverty, lack of opportunity, family problems. We can address those issues that are leading to criminal behavior by giving help and support to these people in the community. And what we get back as a community when we do this is, number one, people who are treated that way are less likely to reoffend, and that means we have a safer community. Number two, there's a substantial racial component to the mass incarceration. And so if we can reduce or eliminate mass incarceration, we're going to make steps toward achieving racial justice. And number three, the community gets a big dividend in the savings of money that we're wasting on jails and prisons right now. That can be reinvested in the community.
With respect to substance abuse and mental health issues driving criminal conduct, we have acknowledged that, and I was proud to play a leadership role in establishing a therapeutic mental health docket for the first time in Central Virginia. And I've expanded the number of people in our drug court to near parity with the city of Charlottesville. It used to be about 30%, it's now about 50%. And that is identifying people who benefit from treatment rather than jail. And that's something that I'm committed to and will continue to be supportive of. If you look at the bookings data over the last several years at the ACRJ, the city of Charlottesville has a smaller population than the county of Albemarle, less than half. And their booking volume per capita is higher. It's higher. And it reflects underlying activity, and we can't disregard that. It's important to look at crime not as a generic statistic, but as a recognition that behind every crime is a victim who deserves accountability and a fair shot at justice. And it's important that this discussion be driven by statistics and not slogans, facts, not fiction. And it's so important that we all take a holistic approach to understanding what are the causes of criminal misconduct, but not being so lacking in compassion that we fail to hold people accountable for criminal misconduct when it occurs. Law enforcement is sort of like the first responder. It's like the emergency room at the University of Virginia. They get priority one calls for service and they respond. The emergency division does the same thing. We have to respond to those calls for service. We have to respond to those bookings. We have to ensure justice and accountability in our community and make sure that we apply the law fairly and without bias. That's what equal justice under law means.
Thank you. So this is a question for both of you, but it keys in on something you've already talked about, Mr. Tracy, and that is, what is your commitment to other alternatives to incarceration? And you talked about the mental health and drug court. And I guess to expand on this question a little bit, is there a need to change the law to allow you to move more into the drug court than 50%? And how about mental health? So.
Well, it wouldn't require legal change. We've been making that progress with respect to drug court in terms of enhancing the percentage of Albemarle participants. The therapeutic jocket, one important part of my support, and Albie would know and other people, Liz Murtaugh, who is the public defender in the audience as well, hired by my opponent while she was, before she became public defender. It's important to recognize that that program was supported by me only after we received authorization and approval from the Virginia Supreme Court. I didn't think it was sufficient to sort of ad hoc that approach without that kind of legal approval. That was very important to me. We also had support from Herb Stewart, and I helped bring him into the discussion. He is married to Dr. Herb Stewart. He's a Western State psychologist married to Liz Palmer on the Board of Supervisors. It represented a bipartisan approach to addressing needs in our community. So the General Assembly could and do more to enhance funding for these sorts of alternative dockets. We have a good population of people in our drug court. We're expanding the number in the therapeutic docket. We are, in some cases, changing or modifying or mending felony charges, particularly if they're larceny charges, petty larceny third or higher, to permit people who are nonviolent from entering these therapeutic programs. And before I agreed to play a role in the process, I consulted with my law enforcement partners, because it's important to realize, and we haven't heard this yet, the Commonwealth's attorney is part of the law enforcement jurisdiction body in whatever jurisdiction he or she is elected, and that's in the Virginia Code. And they support some of these non-punitive dockets because an increasing volume of calls for service come from a very small percentage of the population who would benefit from this kind of treatment. So I would support expanding those efforts and for the General Assembly to provide more funding to make additional participation possible.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Tracy just said again that he would amend felony charges in order to allow people to participate. That's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about here today, and I've talked about before. Prosecutor needs to use discretion to provide for just outcomes to the cases that come in front of the prosecutor. Now, with respect to the therapeutic docket, I acknowledge that Mr. Tracy was a leader in establishing that docket, and give him credit for that. That's a good thing to do. And as he indicated, it's a big community collaboration that went into that. This process started in April of 2015 and went forward from then, and Mr. Tracy came on board in 2016. And so, but you have to realize these sorts of alternatives come about because of community collaboration, and a lot of people play a part in this, including in this case, the Public Defender Office, beginning when I was the Public Defender. Now, do we need more than a therapeutic docket and a drug court? Yes, we do. The information from the last fiscal year is that Albemarle County has currently seven participants in the therapeutic docket, and there were five people who were successful, and so they've graduated and gone on, and good for them, that's great. But the program is very small. So my point in being interested in increasing resources that this community has to offer to keep people in the community instead of wasting time on wasting the community's time and money on excessive incarceration, is that as a criminal justice system leader, I will continue to participate in those community collaborations that will generate more resources, more programs, things that we can reach out and help more than the 12 people who've been in the therapeutic docket from Albemarle County.
The next question, and I'm sure that you've had a chance to look.
Comment just briefly on the number? Our participation rate is about what the city's is, and the reason that is we have a high-risk model for participation in that therapeutic docket. Low-risk people are not qualified for entry according to its rules because we're trying to help people who present with high needs. And with those high needs come a higher failure rate. So as we all discussed, you weren't part of those discussions, we wouldn't be surprised and shouldn't be surprised that a lot of people would not succeed. That's a reflection of how difficult it is to get into the program, not the overall quality of it.
Can you talk a little bit about, and you both have a chance to respond, can you talk a little bit of how you determine whether somebody's high risk or low risk?
That, fortunately, and that was one of the reasons I asked Dr. Stewart to participate, is a judgment call of the therapeutic docket team, mental health professionals, Region 10, OAR, people who are qualified to make mental health decisions. I certainly don't assume that authority or responsibility or knowledge.
Mr. Hensley, do you want to talk about high risk and low risk and what role that plays?
And we do have instruments for measuring risk. But this is the point, and I think Mr. Tracy has made it. This program is targeted to a specific population, a population of high-risk individuals. And this is a population that, as he says, generates a very small number of participants. The figures that I gave you were the figures that I got from the OAR head who compiles those statistics. So, but that isn't the end of it. The point is, we can do more. So why don't we have a program that targets low-risk people? Why don't we have other programs that can be successful in addressing criminal behavior in our community and keeping people from having to be sent away to jail for excessive sentences? So yes, this is a good program, but let's do more, and that's what I would do if I were elected as Commonwealth's attorney.
Thank you. Mr. Tracy, it's reported here that you asked the Board of Supervisors a month ago for additional $100,000 for staff to prosecute more cases. Can you talk about what you see as the needs for your office?
I don't know upon what you're relying that question.
Let me generalize.
If the person is in the audience who asked that question, I'd be very curious.
Well, let me generalize it. What changes would you like to see in your staffing funding for the Commonwealth Attorney?
Yeah, I would like to know the source of that, because that we have made no formal request for $100,000 of anything from the Board of Supervisors. What we have seen over the last few years is an actual reduction in the expenditure to that office, and I'm proud of that, because I consider myself a steward of taxpayer funds, and I'm pleased that the taxpayers of Albemarle County support that office, not the Board of Supervisors. They don't write those checks out of their own pocket. It's everyone in this room who helps support our office. And we do get a supplement from the county, which permits us to hire people from other parts of the Commonwealth to work in that office. And I'm proud of some of the people that we've attracted and retained as a result. So we have actually saved money over the last few years. And it's important to recognize that with respect to the Board of Supervisors, some people, while we've undertaken more cases, so that's something to keep in mind, that the Board of Supervisors sometimes doesn't understand. I won't say this about everyone, but some of them sometimes lose understanding. I think Rick Randolph is the outgoing Scottsville member who thought that, you know, because that supplement was provided, that it was sort of like the appropriate appropriations authority of Congress, that they could start making demands of the office, like do this and do that. It is a separate constitutional office under Virginia law for a reason. That's to protect the office from being susceptible to precisely that type of political pressure. I see another constitutional officer, former constitutional officer here, Sheriff Ed Robb, thank you for being here. He understands that. It's got to be a separate office, bringing cases consistent with the law without regard to politics, and certainly without regard to political pressure from the Board of Supervisors.
Mr. Hendler, the question is generalized, and that is, what changes would you like to see in the office?
Well, I would like to see the office be able to prosecute effectively. Take, for example, the Jason Kessler case, where Mr. Tracy brought a charge, a perjury charge, against Jason Kessler, who was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally, and in the process of trying that case, declined to, or forgot to, or made a mistake of not proving that the crime occurred in Albemarle County. As a result, the case was lost, and the victim of that crime did not get justice, and the community did not get justice. So the most important priority that I see is improving the quality of the prosecution in the prosecutor's office, and that's an example. And I would add that Mr. Tracy is incapable of learning from the mistake that he made in that very serious case, because he has said that it was not a mistake. The mistake belonged to Judge Cheryl Higgins, who was the one who ruled against him. So I think that we need a change in the prosecutor's office in order to have effective and competent prosecution in Albemarle County. Now, beyond that, I think we need to have an office that shares the values that I have and the values that I believe this community has. And that's why this is an elected office, because this is a chance for the community to decide whether we want to continue the outdated policies of mass incarceration or whether we want to make a change that can bring about a safer community and can bring about saving money from excessive incarceration that we're now seeing now. So,
Mr. Tracy, since you were directly mentioned in Mr. Hensley's response, let me give you 30 seconds to respond to what...
30 seconds. Okay.
32.
Okay, you know, this is a January 2017 event on the downtown mall in Charlottesville, Virginia. Consulting with law enforcement, waiting for evidence from the state lab, brought this case in the county of Albemarle. Perjury. There was a person here who was accused of utilizing force without justification here. The charge against that individual was dismissed with prejudice in the city. As I think my opponent knows, perjury affects an individual. It also has a victim as the Commonwealth of Virginia, because it's a crime against the state in terms of not telling the truth before a panel. I disagreed with the court's decision in that case. Courts routinely reopen matters if there's any reason to clarify, sometimes on their own motion. Court did not do so in that case. It's important to recognize, and I don't make a habit of criticizing the circuit court, and I'm not going to start now. The court has that decision making. Scott Goodman, defense lawyer, maybe with as much experience as my opponent, said another court could have found otherwise. But it's important to recognize in this context, it happened in January 2017, and that we prosecute conduct, not identity. That's something that my opponent doesn't seem to understand.
Okay, let me end for the last question. The last question is, what is your position as far as notifying ICE of somebody that you've decided to prosecute?
Who's first on this?
I think you're.
I am, okay. ICE notification, this comes up a lot. I believe that ICE should be notified according to the law. There's a law that says when somebody's booked into the jail, ICE gets notified. And so the issue that has been created in this debate and in the prosecutor's race this time is, what about another separate voluntary notification that occurs at the time somebody's being released? That voluntary notification is a matter of jail board policy. The prosecutor does not sit on the jail board. The prosecutor does not have a say in the determination of that policy. Now, of course, the prosecutor can advise, and Mr. Tracy does that. And Mr. Tracy says, we think that the jail board, the jail staff, needs to do the job that ICE has to do. They need to help ICE out, as if ICE doesn't have enough resources to get the job done. I say, and I spoke out as a citizen in January of 2018, I spoke out at the jail board, I say ICE should do its job. ICE should get the notice, which is required by law, and if they identify somebody in the jail who is a target of their interest, then it's up to them to take the appropriate steps to get that person get a warrant, a judicially issued warrant, or whatever steps it takes to get that person within the ICE jurisdiction. And they're not doing that because the federal government, they just want to do it the easy way. They want to pass down one more responsibility to the locality. And I disagree with that. But remember, what we're talking about here is a matter of policy, not a matter of law.
Thank you.
Mr. Tree.
My opponent is correct. It has generated considerable public attention, and I see several people who showed up to weigh in on that issue in the audience today. I was asked by Diantha McKeel, who was the chair of the board at the time and also a member of the Board of Supervisors, my opinion on the issue. So was a Commonwealth attorney from Nelson County, and the sheriff is on the board. And five of the six law enforcement officers who weighed in took my position, which is supporting continued notification. That was Sheriff Harding, who's endorsed me for this race, the sheriff in Nelson, Commonwealth attorney in Nelson, Sheriff Brown from the city of Charlottesville, very importantly, and the U.S. attorney in Roanoke. Now, immigration authority is vested in the federal branch, in the federal agency. And it's important to not try to subvert or undermine the lawful exercise and application of the immigration laws. Congress has provided ICE authority to request detainers of non-citizens who are subject to priority deportation review. These are administrative warrants that permit a facility to hold someone pending a notification to ICE. It's important to recognize that our jail does not hold any non-citizen a day past their state charges. All this does is to say, because ICE is not in the jails, and there are very few removal agents in this jurisdiction, before you release someone wanted for detention and wanted for priority deportation hearings, give us some notice. We have seen the catastrophic public safety consequences when that doesn't occur in other jurisdictions. It's important to not be selective about what federal law we uphold. This part of the country has had a very unfortunate history of being selective about federal law. And it's important that we apply the law fairly and that we not subvert the law as the proponents of ending notification openly advocated at those board meetings. That was the message that was communicated at those board meetings. Very important to me as a first-generation American whose parents are both immigrants to this country, that there be a lawful distinction between illegal and non-legal immigration. It's a very important point none of us should forget.
Mr. Tracy, since you went last with the opening comments, you start with the closing comments. 2 minutes, please.
Well, I think there are some fundamental differences between my opponent and me. Some of them were made clear today. Indicting cases to find out what happened. That is a dangerous statement from someone seeking the office of Commonwealth's attorney. The understanding that I am a legal advocate, not a social justice advocate, as my opponent described himself. That I am a law enforcement officer, not a legislator or someone else who substitutes his judgment for that of the General Assembly. And the experience I've had as a prosecutor in state and federal court that my opponent completely lacks. It is important also to understand that my opponent has received direct contributions from individuals who have spent unprecedented sums of money in this race. $50,000 individual contribution from one. I see other members of the defense bar who've written $5,500 checks. I represent everyone in this room. I do not and will not place the office up for sale to any individual contributor or anybody else. It is important that I uphold my oath of office to faithfully and impartially apply the law without bias. Finally, it is extraordinarily important to emphasize that the progressive prosecutor movement is a recent development in American jurisprudence and American law only because for most of our history, people reflexively and intuitively understood how unfair and how inconsistent with our structure of government it is for a prosecutor to associate himself with a partisan ideological label. It's inconsistent with the role of a prosecutor, undermines public safety, undermines confidence in the fair administration of justice, and is inconsistent with what the oath of office confers. The authority to apply the law fairly without bias to obtain equal justice under the law.
Thank you, Mr. Hensley.
Thank you. Well, you just heard Mr. Tracy say that I have a partisan ideological label and that I'm political, but he's not. Well, let me tell you, he's running as a Republican, and in 2015 he ran as a Republican. Now, we know from this race for sheriff that you can run as an independent if you want, but he chooses to run as a Republican. So is he non-political, a non-political Republican? What's in it for him as a Republican? Well, I'll tell you one thing that's in it for him. He'd been in office for less than 15 months when he asked Donald Trump to appoint him to a position in the Trump administration, a position that would take him away from Albemarle County, a position that tells you what he's really interested in as being prosecutor here. He's interested in using the citizens of Albemarle County as a stepping stone to some other office. And do you think for a minute that Donald Trump would have considered him for that job if he said, look, I'm not a Republican prosecutor, I'm a non-political prosecutor? Of course not. He's in this for politics. And don't accuse me of being a partisan because I express progressive values. Values are what this election is all about. That's why you have a vote. Vote for these values that reflect what the community wants to see in its criminal justice system. Now, money, yes, I've gotten some big contributions, and so has he. He got a $10,000 contribution from Richard Baxter Gillum, who gives only to Republicans. Again, is it because he's non-political, or is it because he's a Republican? So let's put to rest this idea that calling yourself a progressive and expressing values about what you want to see in the criminal justice system is political. It's not. So he's also said that he will use discretion. He said it over and over again, and that's what I'm saying. So it's not, being a prosecutor is not an automatic, mechanical process. It's applying your values to the situations that are presented in the office and working in the interest of justice for the whole community, and that's what I would do.
So I've decided what I've decided to give Mr. Tracy and Mr. Hensley another 30 seconds because the closing statement ended up making charges. So let me,
It was a very direct political charge, accusing me of utilizing this office for additional public office. I'm very happy here. I'm here with my wife, supporting her career and our family and my young daughter and her schedule. And I make no apology for that whatsoever. I'm very proud of it. The National Sheriff's Association, Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, supported me for that position. They asked me to consider it. I, as I said at the time, am happy here and continue to be happy here. So I would expect going forward that you get the facts straight before you make personal allegations like that. I continue. I seek public office again for the same reason, to uphold the law, to provide dignity, and to be a voice and compassionate voice to victims of crime. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hensley, 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, this question was premised on making charges, and it sounded like Mr. Tracy was the one who got charged. Did you not hear him say that I sold my office for a campaign contribution? That's a charge, and I do not sell this office for a campaign contribution. I have integrity, and this community knows that I have integrity. So we're talking about charges back and forth here.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I want to, if you give everybody a thank you for coming.
Thanks, John.
Very much appreciated. We're going to take a 5-minute break to set up for the state senator candidate.
Sorry about that,
Brian.
Thank you,
sir.
I needed to address with
him. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. Really appreciate
thanks for
it.
Having us.
I hope you feel good about getting the word out.